This is not like TV, only better.
It's only fair to pay for quality first-run movies.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Folks, we're here for Screen Watching. It's the very first episode of our brand new podcast. My name is Dan Barrett, joined here by Simon Foster.
Good morning, Dan. That's the first time I've heard our very jaunty intro theme. I'm very excited by that. Well done cutting that together. And great to be here for Screen Watching.
If I was listening to this podcast for the first time, I'd say, hey, look, this is innovative. Two guys talking about movies and TV shows. But to that, I would counter this. The reason why Simon and I wanted to start doing this podcast is that we kind of thought there was a bit of a gap in what people are putting out there in podcasts. So we're here in Sydney, Australia. We listen to a whole bunch of podcasts from both Australia, but from around the world. But it just kind of felt like there was a sort of real gap of people talking about when movies are actually available in Australia, when TV shows are playing in Australia, and where they're playing, and what's happening at like film festivals that are around the place. Like even just talking about our local cinema, it just kind of felt like there was a sense of localism missing from our film experience. Each week, we're going to do a little bit of news. So we're going to talk about what's going on, provide some of our perspective on it. We're going to have the occasional interview. So we're going to have an interview this week. Simon, who are we talking to?
We're talking to Luke Spark, a young film director who at the very junior age of mid-20s, didn't do my research, but he has directed two blockbuster Australian sci-fi action movies, Occupation and its sequel, Occupation Rainfall, which is in cinemas as we speak. So we'll be chatting with him in the middle of the show.
Yeah, like big blockbuster action sci-fi film, that's not something you really hear from an Australian movie. But no, you go to the cinema and see this thing and it's a big budget sci-fi action film.
Yeah, it absolutely is. It's we're all got our fingers crossed that a movie like this, which as you say, doesn't come along very often, does big business, and hopefully we'll see some more big, dumb Hollywood-style action movies coming out of the Australian industry.
Yeah, we're also going to do reviews on the show as well. So later on this today, we're going to talk about The Stand being the new Amazon Prime Video show. It's CBS All Access in the US, but here we've got on Amazon Prime Video. And Simon, you went to the movies and saw...
I got out to see Malcolm and Marie before it debuts on Netflix next week. It's having a small theatrical season here in Australia, and I understand in the US as well. So, yeah, we'll be looking at that. Zendaya and John David Washington in a very intense romantic drama.
Anyway, it's a big show. Let's get on with it. So, Simon, it seems like a very good place to start with the very first podcast to maybe discuss the fact that the movie industry collapsing around our ears right now. If you want to look at it from a negative way, you could sort of say that it's collapsing, but I think it's just in a state of change and flux, and what we perceive as movies and the movie-going experience is just changing and evolving to a place that makes more sense for our digital selves.
Yeah, look, the film industry has gone through some seismic changes in its 100-plus years. The advent of sound, the advent of colour, the booming sort of VHS years, little bits along the way like 3D and widescreen and all that sort of stuff. What we're finding with the exhibition space now because of the pandemic are that the traditional blockbuster releases, the traditional model for distribution is changing entirely. And as you say, the distribution industry, the studio system is in a total state of flux. Had we had a quote-unquote normal year last year of releases, we would already own on DVD films like Ghostbusters Afterlife, Fast and Furious 9, No Time to Die, Top Gun Maverick. They'd have all gone through their theatrical runs to date and come out the other end. But everything's changed.
Yeah, sorry, I'm confused. DVD, what is that exactly?
Yeah. I'm an old man, everyone. Yes, there, you caught me.
But no, the thing with, well, basically every industry has been affected by the pandemic, obviously. Yeah. And what the general sort of rule of thumb has been across the board, regardless of the industry you're in, is they say that things that were going to happen within your industry 5 years from now have just been sped up to happen within the last 12 months. So there's a lot of scrambling going on to the point where these big blockbuster films that were supposed to come out over the last 7 or 8 months, they've all been delayed to the point where some of them we're not seeing till 2022 now. Mm. So talking about some of those titles, like from maybe the big one is the James Bond film. So everyone was looking for that. And again, this is a film that we would have seen by now. It's been bumped a couple of times. The new date for that's October 8th. Ghostbusters Afterlife was supposed to come out last July. Now it's coming out on November 11.
Yeah, they've been bounced all over the place. Peter Rabbit 2, which was shot here in Sydney as we record this, it was to release back in June, then it was bumped to February, then it went to April, then to August. Now it's just all over the place for a major sequel. And as you say, Ghostbusters Afterlife, which was a film that had a great deal of buzz about it, Jason Reitman, son of Ivan, who directed the first film, the first Ghostbusters, he returns, great young cast, buzz was really high on it. But Sony Pictures, as they have with a lot of their product, have had to readjust. And in readjusting, that also means letting the stock market know, letting the shareholders know that things are going to shift around and that they're going to be looking for different revenue streams along the way. So it's been an extraordinary time.
Yeah. So obviously a lot of the studios that are releasing movies also have streaming services now. And some of those streaming services are global. Some of them are just local in the US markets particularly. And we always have to look at movies from that US perspective, and that's where most of the big movies get made. So whatever's happening in the US market has flow-on effects to the rest of the world. So thinking about things like Warner Brothers, for example, obviously they've got very high-profile HBO Max. Mm. They've announced day and date with all their movies. So they've more or less adjusted their schedule and said, look, these are the movies as they're going to come out over 2021. And day and date, they'll be there on HBO Max because the big markets for cinemas in the US.
Yeah, coastal markets are the biggest. And you're absolutely right. With Warner Brothers have taken this really sort of, I guess you could call it proactive. And even though a lot of the theatre owners have complained that things like Wonder Woman will get a month in people's homes before it reverts back to a purely cinema release, Warner Brothers are arguing that, well, theatre owners, at least we're telling you when it's going to come out. You know when you're going to get our slate of big releases, when Matrix 4 and when those sort of movies are going to drop in your cinemas. We're not going to keep shifting and changing schedules. We're going to hold to our HBO Max distribution plan and you'll get them in cinemas too.
More importantly, they're not actually just saying, hey, look, here's when you're going to get it. They're actually getting them.
Yeah.
As opposed to every other distributor, which is saying, no, we're just going to hold off for a year. So at least they've actually got like content to play. And if you think about that flow-on effect to Australia and the rest of the world, like people can actually go and see movies in, because obviously it's not just affecting the US, like globally, everyone's heavily affected by the pandemic. Mm. In Australia and New Zealand and a couple of other small pockets around the world, we're incredibly fortunate where we could quite comfortably go to the cinema and not get sick.
Yeah.
Okay, but that's not a chance that a lot of people can take. And a lot of territories have their cinemas closed. But it does mean that if Warner Brothers is saying, hey, look, you know, we've got the new Denzel Washington film dropping in March, it means in Australia, we'll actually get a Denzel Washington film. And so that's quite the change from last year where, look, I mean, the movie going experience, which is filled with dregs of things that would ordinarily go direct to digital or just retro films. Like I saw so many old classics.
Yeah.
I went and saw The Exorcist on a big screen purely because there were no other movies around. And what a great experience in a cinema by myself watching The Exorcist.
The international sector really suffered because the US distributors, the US studio system didn't want to acknowledge that a movie could go to the global market before it opened in America. Finally, Warner's once again said, you know, okay, we'll listen to you. We'll release Tenet in all these markets. Unfortunately, Tenet got some mixed reviews from the critics, some mixed response from the movie going public. So it was then held up as an example of, you know, we're not going to try that again. You guys didn't want Tenet as it turned out. So it ended up doing not very well.
You know what's funny about Tenet though? Because you didn't have that US marketing effort take place as well, I kind of feel that internationally, here in Australia particularly, I think we hear a lot of the interviews and stuff that come from US talk shows and podcast appearances and the general discussion that happens around movies and shows. And so we sort of factor that into the way that we approach a movie coming.
Sure.
So we hear about it first in that US context and then we apply it to our own, you know, viewing experience. Because it didn't come out in the US, we didn't actually have that advanced buzz.
Yep.
And so I think maybe the interest in Tenet was maybe a bit more muted than it would have been otherwise, purely because we just didn't really know what the film was or have any sort of pre-existing relationship to it.
Which also highlighted the fact that as hard as distributors and Warner Brothers partners around the world work to get word of Tenet out there, without that wave of US marketing support that comes in advance of most big releases, you're right, it struggled to overcome any negatives in the marketplace and to, you know, maybe fulfill its potential. Now, with Wonder Woman 2, with Wonder Woman 1984,
which is the 1984th Wonder Woman film in the series.
Exactly, yes. I missed the other 1983, so I didn't watch it. News broke overnight that through AT&T that they said that Wonder Woman 1984 helped HBO Max double its activations in the fourth quarter of 2020. I know this is all pretty sexy talk for our first podcast, but they got 17...
Well, calm down. I'm overheating here.
17.2 million activations based on what they think is the Wonder Woman 1984 factor. So that's not going to change any studio's decision to head straight to the screening platforms. Disney did very well off the Mulan release last year, which went straight to their Disney Plus premium platform, as well as playing theatrical around the world. Wonder Woman 1984 sort of topped out at about 130 million globally, which is way down on what they would have hoped for as a box office receipts. But chances are they'll make that up into varying degrees on their HBO Max platform. So, to go back to the point we started with, it's a changing world in terms of how we watch movies.
Yeah, I guess looking forward, there's two films that I think everyone should pay attention to see what the US is doing with their big release films, and particularly where cinema going is at in terms of, like, all these movies are being announced for this, Warner Brothers aside, all these movies are announced for, hey, here's the new date, but this is ever shifting. If the pandemic lasts that little bit longer than they're really expecting throughout the US, or if customer behaviors don't really align with people feeling safe to go to the cinemas, like, these dates shift again. So the two that maybe to pay attention to try to get the sort of feel as to what's going on around the place is in May, you've got Marvel through Disney launching Black Widow, and whether that actually gets a cinema release, it gets pushed to Disney Plus is the big question. Mm-hmm. And that's a film that probably won't get delayed because, as with all the Marvel content, one bit of Marvel feeds into the next thing with plot points and characters that move through. And obviously they've got teasers that exist within the films as well. If Black Widow gets pushed back, then they have to push back all of their movies and all of their TV shows, and it becomes a bit of a mess. Mm. So that would probably just go straight to Disney Plus, I would imagine. So what they do there, whether it's a freebie for Disney Plus or if it's a, you know, you pay your $30 and get access to Black Widow, that's a big question. The other one to look at, Viacom CBS launching their new streaming service called Paramount Plus. They've also got a big film coming out soon. It's a little thing called Top Gun 2. Mm. The big hot sort of rumor at the moment is that that may actually launch day and date with Paramount Plus. They'll Wonder Woman 1984 and say, hey, look, here's Top Gun 2. Go and see the new Tom Cruise film. And also, while you're at it, check out our new streaming service.
Yeah, the other thing we're not talking about here is how the creative community are reacting to this. Already, Christopher Nolan, the director of Tenet, has come out and said, well, I'm not working with Warners anymore if my movie is going to sort of drum up the small screen experience. A good many directors and writers and creative types have come out and said there's no way to do business. We're opening a Pandora's box, and maybe this is something we can discuss on another podcast. But it's certainly a changing landscape for everybody involved in the industry. Good on us for trying to release a preview review podcast in the middle of all this, because it's going to be hard to know what we're talking about every week.
But that's the reason why I think this podcast is great, because it's trying to make some sense and give people sort of guideposts as, hey, look, this is when this movie's coming out. This has come out. Maybe check that out. I think this is actually probably an important time to have chats like this.
Good call. Good save. Yep.
Yeah. Now, very quickly wrapping this up, and this ties into exactly what we've been talking about as well. Disney are launching a brand new streaming service. This one's geared towards adults. It's called Star. So we're getting it here in Australia. We're going to be one of the launch territories for Star. They're not getting Star in the US. So in the US, Disney already own Hulu, which kind of caters towards their adult viewership there. And there's all sorts of reasons why it's not the same platform. And I'm not going to bother getting to that this week. But what we found out this week is with Star, which is going to launch as part of Disney Plus. So it's not going to be a standalone subscription service. Rather, Disney Plus is going to be a couple more bucks a month. And it's going to be an additional tile just at the top of Disney Plus, which you can click into that and see all of your Star content. Of course, if you're an adult like myself without any kids in a household, you can also, when you're going to Star for the first time, a pop-up box will come up saying, hey, do you just want to integrate this into the rest of your Disney Plus? I'll hit the yes button. And then suddenly, anytime I go to Disney Plus, will be a mix of all the mature Star content alongside all the family-friendly Disney Plus content.
Right.
What we found out during the week is, like, all the launch titles for day one of Star.
Pretty extensive, isn't it? There's a lot of...
It's very impressive. It's 450-plus movies, 155-plus TV shows. So, like, that's a lot of content being added. And this is all stuff that came from the purchase primarily of 20th Century Fox.
Yeah.
So you've got a whole bunch of things like The X-Files, for example, the Alien movies, the Die Hard films, Predator movies.
Plus, what I found really interesting was that there's, when Disney Plus launched, there was a little bit of a murmur amongst people of my age that some of the more adult touchstone titles that were there in the 80s and 90s didn't get a look in on Disney Plus. And things
so
like...
One of them did. So Splash did. But yes. Then there was like some weird CGI editing where you couldn't see Daryl Hannah's bottom because they added some hair to it.
Exactly right. So that's why I didn't watch it. There I go back to my DVD, as you call it. So I'm excited to find the full series run of the classic cop show Hill Street Blues on Disney Star is a huge moment for me. That's a seminal show in my television watching history. My so-called life, the one season wonder that starred Claire Danes, is also popping up on Disney Star, and that's going to be a must watch as well, because it's kind of disappeared from the world until now.
A couple of the TV gems I found in there. If you look at the Disney Plus media release, they'll talk about shows like Alias or Felicity, Desperate Housewives, Bob's Burgers, Dollface, Black-ish, Ugly Betty. But going through there, for me, I was excited by Hill Street Blues. So all seven seasons will be there. Firefly's there, Angel. There's a really fun sitcom that I think got played here at like 11:30 at night on Channel 7 called The Trophy Wife. And while it's a bit of a stumbling first two or three episodes, there's some fantastic gold in that show that I was super excited to see more people might discover now. A great show called Bunheads, which is about a group of girls who learn ballet in, I guess, you know, regional US somewhere. It's a coastal town. Movie-wise, there's some big films on there, like, say, Titanic, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, Grand Budapest Hotel, Pretty Woman, the Die Hard films, Devil Wears Prada, Moulin Rouge. But then also digging through, I was excited to see the Alien movies, most of the Planet of the Apes movies. So they've got all the three most recent ones. I've got the 1968 classic, and then the fifth film from that series, Battle for the Planet of the Apes.
Oh, the really nutty one.
Well, that's the worst one of all of them.
No. So you're going to start getting emails. People say that it's the most subversive and darkest and strangest of the lot, thereby making it the best. I haven't seen Battle for years. That's going to be one of the first ones I'm watching on Disney.
No. I think you're confusing Battle for the Planet of the Apes with Conquest of the Planet of the Apes.
That I may be. Darkest.
Yes.
They all got kind of nutty in those last couple of ones. Things kind of, they were reaching for the stars, let's face it.
Look, if right now you want me to do the rankings of Planet of the Apes films from best to worst, I'm prepared to do it, but we're not going to do that this week. We're going to give some sizzle for next week. We're not going to do that next week. However, so I've got two of the original films. I'm missing three of them from the middle. Yeah, three from the middle, doing my rough maths there. And I don't think the Tim Burton one was there. So whether that's a good thing or not, you know, you decide. Some other cool things on there. I saw Face Off, the 1986 The Fly, Gross Point Blank, Unstoppable, right. Kissing Jessica Stein, Ed Wood. Like, it's a good mix of good Hollywood films. And I saw a very snide remark from someone on Facebook saying that I just kind of feels like the $2 bin. But to me, I'd argue that when I went to video stores and rented out like a whole bunch of weeklies, I was never disappointed with my large pile of movies. Like, there was
a
lot of fun we had.
The channels, the range of choice that we have currently on the streaming platforms is becoming more and more like the video store experience from your couch, of course, and with your remote. But I mean, I've spent time sort of clicking through the Stan package and clicking through the Netflix package, going really deep into their catalog. The Amazon Prime one's terrific as well. I watched this 1977 Australian film called Summerfield the other week, which is on the, I think, on the Stan lineup. There's a lot of great Aussie content on that package. So you're right. It's become very much a video store experience. Yes, there's that lack of sort of interaction with the rest of the public that we all loved back in the dark old days of video store rentals. But yeah, I think with the Disney Star package, it's ongoing.
So Simon Foster, there's a brand new film hitting cinema screens this week. It's called Occupation Rainfall. Tell us about it.
Luke Spark is living the dream of every little boy or girl who ever spent days playing with their action figures, the Star Wars action figures of my youth anyway. He's still playing, but now it's with millions of dollars, and the action figures are Dan Gillies and Dan Ewing and Jason Isaacs and Ken Jeong. That's some pretty good action figures. His latest film, Occupation Rainfall, is a big, blustery alien invasion action epic. It's in cinemas now. Let's talk movies with Luke Spark. Welcome to Screen Watching, mate.
Yeah, hello. Great to be here with you guys.
It's a joy having you here. You seem so softly spoken in person. This is the first time we've had a chance to talk. How did you corral all those mad egos and wild action scenes and all that sort of stuff on the set of the film?
Trust me, when I have to, I definitely have a loud voice, and my director tantrums are quite well known. I'm very much a micromanager when it comes to a film like this. So every day, everyone always knew the wrath of Luke would be around.
Listen, I want to ask about the first film, about Occupation. It absolutely punched above its weight, securing, you know, a smattering of theatrical engagements around the world and then hitting very big as a home viewing favourite. Who pushed hardest for a continuation of this story, you or the Money Men?
Me. Yeah. Then I have to convince, then I got to convince the Money Men. Luckily, our producers are a big backer of mine, so they're on board straight away as soon as I told them. And then it was up to getting the rest of the Money Men on board.
Was it a easy continuation to pick up as a storyteller for you to pick up where the first one left off? Was a second and maybe a third film always envisaged?
To be honest, it wasn't. I hit the ground Occupation 1 and I pitched it as just like a really small $1 million run around the bush with a camera for a couple of weeks with some alien costumes as like something to do between A and C of our film career. And then once I had Tamir Morrison signed on and Jacqueline McKenzie and Bruce Spence, I was like sort of a bit left with my pants down to sort of think, oh, this is a bit bigger than what I thought it might be. And I was sort of always running to catch up and making it as big as I could. This one, I sort of sat everyone down halfway through the editing process and said, look, I've got an idea for a sequel. It's going to be bigger. It's going to be much more expensive. We'll figure out how to do it later. But this time I'm going to go in knowing that it's going to be big.
Yeah, now your first Occupation film is currently streaming on Netflix. Anecdotally, have you noticed much of a marked increase of awareness around the film? So are people actually coming up to you talking about the movie in a way that you probably wouldn't have without the Netflix bump?
Yeah, definitely. Like once we went on Netflix, exponentially, the reactions and the people in the audience coming up to me was a lot bigger. It opened in Netflix America first and actually opened at number one. Like more people streamed it that week, the 2 weeks, than anything else. And that was a great bump for us. And suddenly, you know, I was on the radar of different actors and different studios, and that made it a lot easier.
Yeah, so awareness is obviously great, but with the awareness coming from Netflix, does that change anything with the rollout of the new film? Like, do you change your marketing plans, or is there anything that needs to be adjusted?
Not really. Like, once everyone started getting a look at this film, once it was quite a long ways away in the edit, that's when cinemas started to sign on with this film. So we sort of went bigger with the theatrical release and knew that's what we should aim for all this time. And then, you know, we'll start negotiating the streaming platform after this weekend, once this film's out.
Mate, the Australian sci-fi action thriller, the wholly Australian-made sci-fi action thriller, it's a pretty rare beast. And I guess to paraphrase Bill Pullman, this is our Independence Day, but these sort of films don't pop up much from our industry. Why not?
I think it's because how big and expensive they are. Like, I had to come up with a lot of ideas of how to make these films, Rainfall at least, look like it was maybe, you know, $50 million, $100 million, you know, on not that much budget. So I think, and there's just so many gatekeepers and so many risk aversion people when it comes to, I guess, anything in life. Entertainment industry is no exception. So once people start reading the script and they go, oh my God, we can't do this. And I don't really take that advice. I say, we can do it. And if they open the door, we'll go through a window. And you know, if we can't get through a window, we'll go through the chimney or whatever. You know?
Now, you kick off the film in Sydney before you take it out to the outback, taking the film right near Alice Springs. That's a lot of Australia, but it seemed like you're very purposefully steering clear of any of the characters, using like any hardcore Australianisms, all the language and even the behaviour of the characters. It seems very general. And I was wondering how intentional that was, and if there was maybe any temptation along the way to give the characters a bit of a boost of the old Alf Stewart DNA.
It was very intentional. Like, I think as Australia, as a people, we've sort of gone beyond the Alf Stewarts and the castle, like from the 90s and the 80s and the 70s. Like, you know, I cringe when I hear some of the Australianisms coming out. It's not to say I don't like them. And I got characters in there like Zach Garrett, who plays Dennis. He's probably the most Australian person that I know. So I definitely want to keep that sense of Aussieism there. But I just, it was intentional not to keep it general and let's not go too crazy with that stuff.
Mate, you've cited the likes in other interviews of people like James Cameron as an inspiration, as mentor figures, as someone who inspires you. Once they've gone to cinemas to see your film this weekend, what movie should your audience watch to get a glimpse inside your creative mind?
Well, films I grew up on, really, is, you know, I was at the right age around the time Independence Day came out. Actually, you referenced it before, you know. You know, going back to Star Wars is obviously a huge passion of mine. The Mandalorian, Aliens, all those same ones that we all probably saw growing up. It's not too different. I don't really have some sort of crazy out there films that no one's really seen. I'm a pretty sort of mainstream type of person.
Does the works of and then I guess the work ethic, more importantly, of someone like James Cameron inspire you as a director? You mentioned the Wrath of Luke before. Cameron's known for that as well. Is that all you take from what he does?
Yeah, and like I obviously, you know, hearing the stories, you know, as a film fan before I became a director, and then having to be a director on a massive film like this, I can definitely see how it happens. Like, you're either gonna get pushed around by everyone on set, or you got to push them around. Yeah. Titanic is actually one of my top five films of all time, and people obviously look at me with a bit cockeyed when I say that, but it's only because I saw it 12 times in the cinema when it first came out, and I was like however old I was back in that year. I was only like a teenager, but it's just because it was like dripping sort of filmmaking off. I could feel it off the camera, just all the attention to detail and just the storytelling, and just it's just one of those times that's captured me at that particular age of just being like, holy crap, this is just good filmmaking.
And he's, you know, famously clashed with Kate Winslet on that. The only thing more entertaining than The Abyss is hearing Ed Harris not talk about The Abyss. He won't ever talk about his time making that with James Cameron.
That's true.
Yeah, he's an amazing figure, and you got every your instincts are exactly right in following in his footsteps.
I guess for me, I've always tried to sort of trying to find the line between, say, Michael Bay and Spielberg. It's kind of like the Spielberg sensibilities, but the Michael Bay, like, fucking the camera and all that kind of stuff.
So as a fan of big budget, mainstream, big, exciting cinema, I know, speaking from my own experience, going to the cinema at the moment, it's a very dry spell for that. There's nothing else really playing like that in the cinema because of, obviously, the stupid virus and, you know, we're kind of reliant on that US product coming through. But you look around and it's kind of a great time for Australian cinema. So while you don't have the big budget films, you do have, and particularly this week, you've got like The Dry playing in cinemas, you got Penguin Bloom, and that's doing good business. And how do you feel about your film, which feels probably the most Hollywood and big blockbuster-ish of these movies, compared to these smaller Australian films? Do you think that gives you a point of difference maybe while there is so much Australiana around?
Yeah, look, you're 100% right and all that. And obviously we've had lots of discussions internally coming up to this date. Yeah, 100%. I think it's great to see Aussie films do well. I've been watching The Dry and Penguin Bloom, and they're great. I think you should see all of them if you can. But yeah, ours is definitely great to have a point of difference, a bit more broader audience perhaps. But we'll see what happens. I think if our film can crack through and, you know, go well, then it's great for Aussie action, Aussie sci-fi to show that there's like a three quadrant, you know, release that's happened with all these different films and they've all been accepted. So it would be amazing.
Mate, it's in 200 plus cinemas nationwide, I think, something like that.
Yeah, definitely over 200.
Pretty impressive. So tonight in Newcastle at the Event Cinemas Katara, if you switch this podcast off right now, you might be able to make it. At 7 p.m. there, you'll be doing a Q&A. You'll be introducing the film. And then tomorrow, Saturday, January 30 at 7 p.m. in Port Macquarie at the Majestic Cinemas there for all the New South Wales Mid-North Coast listeners. Get along to that. And get along and see this film. It's a blast. It's a big, blustery action movie, like I said, and it's something we don't do very often. It's clearly something we can do very well. So thanks for joining us, Luke.
That's all right. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it.
Big thanks to Luke Spark for joining us here on the very first episode of the podcast. Simon, Occupation Rainfall, and we should maybe just give a bit of a disclaimer here because you do have a relationship with the release of the movie.
Yep. When I'm not doing this, one of the roles I do is the Monster Fest Festival director here in Sydney, and Monster Pictures are releasing or helping in the release of Occupation Rainfall. So, yeah, full disclosure. Having said that, I'll also fully disclose that I didn't like the first film. Occupation was a movie that drove me a little bit nutty, and I remember making a list of all the things that he could do to make a better film. Listen to me, like I know what I'm talking about. And he did all those things in the second film. He tightened up the characters. He improved upon the special effects. He went bigger, but he also had a tighter control of some of the excesses of the genre. So there's a bit less macho posturing in this film than there was in the first one. There's a much better interaction between the characters. And I got to say, the special effects scenes and the stuff that takes place man versus alien wise is a hoot. Like some of the big outer space scenes rival anything you've seen in Independence Day or films of that ilk. So yeah, big thumbs up for this one, and you really should try and see it on the big screen. There's plenty of seats available in cinemas at the moment, so get out there and buy a ticket for Occupation Rainfall.
Look, I will say, I think this film's coming at the exact right time where there are no other big films like this playing on a big screen for the next couple of months. So it's a great opportunity to go and see a big, dumb spectacle on a big screen. That said, I don't think it's a... So I never saw the first film, and I saw you just before I went into the screening of this, and you were like, you don't need to have seen the film. And I think you're right, but I was kind of left wondering who some of the characters were and trying to fill some of those gaps in my mind, which I think made the film a more fun experience going in. Like, I was really sort of in the deep of it, which I kind of liked. But the one thing I thought the film was kind of missing, and it is big, dumb spectacle, so like it's fine, it ticks all the boxes in regards to that. But where I felt the film sort of fell apart a little bit was that, first of all, because it's an Australian film, and you're very much going into it thinking, hey, look, this is going to be an Australian blockbuster film. Let's see what it looks like to see that from our perspective. You kind of want to feel a bit more Australianness from it. So there's a sense of geography that's a little bit skewy with it. Like Pine Gap, which is off near Alice Springs, it kind of feels just as close to the Sydney CBD where we start the film as it does the Blue Mountains. Like it kind of feels like it's an hour and a half away. And like, in fairness, they do stop at like a cattle ranch, which apparently featured in the first film, or so I gather, because people seem very familiar and like us, I thought I should know who these people are. But like they do spend like an overnight there. So they do give like a bit of time passing, but it doesn't really feel like they've traveled a distance to get there.
I would argue that this film is very much hoping to make its money back on international sales and with international audiences, and then they may not bring the familiarity that you and I bring to the geography of Australia.
Look, I totally buy that, okay? But even so, I kind of feel that if you're playing it as an Australian film, at least I feel that every movie or story feels a lot more genuine when it feels like it's coming from a place of honesty. Okay. And because it didn't really feel legitimate to me as a person who's roughly familiar with how long it takes to get to Alice Springs, like I just didn't really quite buy it. And you're so like that kind of felt a little bit hinky.
You're putting a lot of weight on a film that stars Jason Isaacs in a lizard mask for the whole thing.
Well, I don't think he's actually in the mask, is he? Is he not just doing a voice and someone else is in the mask?
Oh, I never thought of that. Oh, God, that's controversial.
And the other thing was, like, both of us live in Sydney. I'm a relatively new transplant to Sydney, so I've kind of worked my way around the city now. And it definitely feels like someone who's not of Sydney making this. So Luke's a Gold Coast-based filmmaker.
He is.
The thing is, when you actually live in Sydney, you know that the main sort of structure of the city is really dependent on, like, three major roads that come in and out of the city. Okay, like, there are massive sort of highway roads sort of right next to where the action is taking place at the very beginning of the film. And so there's a very big action spectacle with all the characters like racing away from aliens, and there's like fights and lasers and pew, pew, pew.
So you'd have been happier if all the, convoy of tanks and trucks had like gone through the toll gates, had paid tolls on their way out of Sydney.
I just want to hear a beep every time they went through. No, like I don't need it to be sort of to that level, but it kind of needed to, because the thing is, if you look at those roads, they're actually visually really interesting looking. There's things you could do there to make it feel like just give people a real kick saying, oh, this is actually the city I recognize. And instead of random building that no one's ever seen before and fictional thing, just maybe make it a real building and give it a sense of real life scale and something to connect into. Like I just kind of felt that was, it was just kind of missing from it. And that kind of carried over to the characters as well, where I kind of thought they were just everyman characters. They could have been Canadian as much as they were Australian. Like there was just no
sense. I think that's intentional. I think that's part of what he's doing.
I get that it's intentional. In fact, Luke just said that in the interview. But okay. I do feel that like I would have connected to the film so much more if there was more specificity to it. And I think that when I watch these films on from like other countries, I can tell the things that actually feel legitimate to the place it's been created from and those that could have been set just anywhere. And I definitely feel that. Like, I don't know why the film necessarily needs to have been set in Australia when it could have been set in, you know, Central City. Like, what's the difference, really?
And that was Dan's rant, everybody. That's sponsored by Too Much Coffee in the Morning.
I'm not really a coffee drinker. I don't know, I just feel the film overall just lacked a sense of personality and Australianness and specificity. That said, I think anyone who's like hungering for one of these sorts of films will go and see this and have a fun time with it. And I suddenly reached the end of it thinking, I'd like to see the third Occupation film. I think that'd be a fun experience to see. But it just didn't really sing to me as like a magic film experience in the way that I'd kind of hope to see something special when I walked in.
Sure. Totally kind of partly agree with you.
So Simon, each week on the show, we will do a couple of reviews. Now we've got two fairly big high profile shows and movies we want to talk about here. Let's go with you first. There's a new Netflix film coming and it wasn't made initially for Netflix, but they did buy the film. And so globally, it's going to be considered a Netflix original. It's called Malcolm and Marie.
Fascinating story behind Malcolm and Marie. It's made by Sam Levinson, son of famous director Barry Levinson, who has made some classic movies in his day, Good Morning Vietnam, Rain Man, films like that. Sam Levinson is one of the key creatives behind the TV series Euphoria, which stars Zendaya, which leads me into Malcolm and Marie. Zendaya and John David Washington play this very volatile couple. He's a film director who's just had a very successful film premiere. She's the long-suffering, much younger girlfriend upon whom the film director has based much of his very popular new film. And this movie catches them right at the end of the film's premiere. They've returned to a very remote cottage in the Malibu Hills. And their relationship starts to unravel when some anxiety about him forgetting to thank her in his welcome speech at the preview flares up. Now, it's very much a volatile romantic drama. There's lots of screaming, lots of yelling. It's shot in black and white. So in many regards, it's a throwback to the Mike Nichols classic, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. The dialogue, which really just zips and zings and pings and sweary, and it is very much cut from sort of that Harold Pinter theatrical experience. And the film itself refers to people like Spike Lee and John Cassavetes, and Barry Jenkins, even sort of going back to the classic directors like William Wyler. This is a very sort of self-referential film that looks at not only the disintegrating nature of this relationship, but also how art and the criticism of art can mess with the artist's head and mess with the artist's life. There are some brutal takedowns of what I do for a living as a critic, and that was great to hear coming from the frenzied mouth of John David Washington. The film itself sort of occasionally dips into this kind of too obvious plot device of using these characters to get a message across. When they're at their most open and heartbreaking, it's a very moving film, but then there are often big, long sort of theatrical type rants that do feel like Sam Levinson is trying to get a message across. But having said that, it's a beautiful looking film. The black and white looks stunning. And the acting, Zendaya is superb. And John David Washington, who we know from BlacKkKlansman and Tenet, is also very good. Not always a pleasant experience because the nature of their disintegrating relationship is at times pretty brutal. But it is a pretty powerful work that I'm glad I saw on the big screen, quite frankly, because the black and white cinematography and the intensity of these performances came across.
Yeah, now it's all filmed in one house, is that right?
It is. It's called the Caterpillar House, I think, and it's quite a famous sort of isolated beachfront building in the Malibu community. And Levinson has some pretty dazzling sort of camera work to capture life inside this small house. A lot of it takes place in sort of the studio apartment, the living room and the kitchen, and the camera sort of whirls back and forth between these sparring partners. And he takes full use of the really stunning sort of monochrome black and white photography. So, yeah, the house itself is a beautiful setting, enlivened by these two beautiful actors sometimes exploding into full rage, and sometimes sort of being very introspective and very sweet as well.
Yeah. Look, so this is a film which is going to be playing on Netflix. I think it starts streaming next week, or is it the week after?
February 5th,
from what I understand. Yeah, next week. But if you do want to catch it, there are a limited number of cinemas around Australia that are playing it. I know here in Sydney, it's being played at the Ritz Cinema, the Randwick Ritz. Outside of that, I don't know if there's any other cinemas playing it.
I'm not sure. Double check. And if you maybe go to our Facebook page, when that's up and live, we'll have some details on there.
Indeed. So, yeah, definitely check your listings for it. And as Simon said, definitely check that out on a big screen if you get the opportunity.
That's my blathering done for the week. Let's go to your blathering. Stephen King's The Stand is getting a mixed response from the fans on Amazon Prime. You've seen a good chunk of this. What are the thoughts?
Look, so Stephen King's The Stand, this is a new series they made for CBS All Access in the US. And I think it's incredibly telling that they decided to drop that as one of the last titles released on CBS All Access before they rebrand it to Paramount Plus in a couple of weeks' time.
Ah.
So definitely look to that aspect of things if you want to see how much faith there was in a production. So Stephen King's The Stand, we're getting it here on Amazon Prime Video. And we're getting it in line with the US. So I think there's maybe a couple of hours difference, and we're getting the episodes more or less the same day, which is very cool to see. Look, I'd say most people know The Stand. If you haven't read the book by Stephen King, which is a Stephen King book, so obviously very widely read. But there's also been a TV series back in 1994. There was a 6-part series. I think we got it as like double parters here on Channel 10 when it played back in the day. But The Stand, if you don't know it, it's a Stephen King novel. The story's about a disease that wipes out the majority of the population. The survivors, who inexplicably never got sick, are drawn by some spiritual figures to join one of two camps. There's a group of good, pure of heart folk in Colorado, and they're led by the mysterious Mother Abigail. And then there's a camp of the rough, no good sorts led by the devilish Randall Flagg, and they're in Las Vegas. Eventually, the two groups end up coming to clash. So it's very much a good versus evil story, framed very much around a pandemic that's wiped out the majority of the people. So if you've read the book or seen the original miniseries, you'd know that the beginning of it starts with a pandemic. You see civilization and life collapse around it with a couple of survivors, then making a road trip to their respective destinations. And then the real story kind of kicks off. The thing with this series is that it's happened at a time of real life pandemic. And I can completely appreciate that they're in production on this and probably nearing the end of production when suddenly a real life pandemic takes place. So they're stuck with a problem. Do you actually just stick to your guns and tell the story as originally intended? Or do you release the story with a way to sort of cut around the pandemic? Now, if you listen to the guy that's responsible for running this, it's Josh Boone. He's the gentleman who directed The Fault in Our Stars and The New Mutants, which was the much delayed Fox Marvel X-Men movie.
He's had some bad luck, Josh, hasn't he? Yeah.
And so he directs, I think, the first episode. I think there might be a second or third episode he directs somewhere in the run as well. But like, I've heard him talk and they'll say, oh, this is exactly as we always planned it. But when you watch it, it doesn't feel right. So for the first three episodes, they deal with the pandemic, but not through showing the pandemic as it has been in through the book and through the original mini, but really they tell it through flashbacks. So by the time the story starts, they're already making their way to Colorado or already at Colorado in some scenes. And then you're seeing the flashback as previously experienced. And by doing it that way, they can cut down the amount of sort of gore and experience of living through a pandemic and making it maybe a little bit too real for the audience. The problem with that, though, is that the entire story is structured very much around people going through how do you even want to explain it? It's really a series of, it's an amount of trauma that they've experienced. There's a lot of heartbreak. There's a lot of survivor's guilt and all sorts of things mixed into the idea that you're one of the last survivors of the human race. And so you've got these people with a large amount of baggage that are making their way to Colorado and then being involved in this ultimate battle between good and evil. But by readjusting the framing of the story and to telling these sort of briefly in flashbacks, the audience isn't really quite there on that journey. Like, the rest of the story should be a road movie taking you from one destination to the other point. And the final destination is supposed to be a very large experience. But because you haven't had that grounding to begin with, and you're kind of treating the pandemic aspect of things more or less as an afterthought, you don't actually have the emotional grounding which actually makes the bombast of the finale have any resonance.
I'll weigh in a bit here because I read The Stand. I read the extended version of The Stand back in the day, and it was a mammoth tome and what is still my favourite Stephen King book.
So I think that's the version that he released in like the mid-90s. So there was like updated references. Is that...
Yeah, that's right. And it was, I think it was originally released through like an American book club or something, and my uncle gave it to me anyway, long story short.
Yeah.
True boring story. That was a, and so it's become my favourite Stephen King novel, still remains that. So I was very excited to see this. I totally agree with you that the tension, the build-up to the confrontation between Mother Abigail and Randall and the nature of all the characters involved seems very perfunctory in this film and in this miniseries. There's no sense of building dread. What you find is that you're introduced to these characters and then you sort of sit back for three or four episodes and just wait for them to have their flashbacks where we learn a little bit about them. And I sort of felt that by midway through the third episode, I really wasn't that invested and I was sort of umming and ahhing about whether I cared enough about any of the other characters to just want to stick with it and see their flashbacks. So I also thought the production of each episode and the production of the miniseries had a very dated look to it. It almost felt like a 90s bit of network television. Although it has some big scenes, and certainly in that first episode, as the scenes where the pandemic takes hold, it impresses. But overall, I thought it was a little bit chintzy, and I think even the casting of and you know, with all due respect, I think James Marsden is a very B sort of movie lead. I think Whoopi Goldberg is with all due respect is, you know, a little bit of stunt casting in that regard. So, I think this is, while watchable, it's very sort of mid-level, middle-tier kind of American TV movie making.
Yeah, look, I think the production quality is a little bit better than you're really giving it credit for, but I do agree with the casting of Marsden, who I really like Marsden, but he's not the lead of what is considered to be a premium drama. Like, it's not quite right. The rest of the cast, so you've got Whoopi Goldberg playing the aforementioned Mother Abigail. You got Alexander Skarsgård, who people would have seen in Big Little Lies as Nicole Kidman's husband in that. He's playing the villain in it, Randall Flagg. But then you've got, as you mentioned, James Marsden's in there. Amber Heard, where she brought a lot of baggage to the role, like external baggage that, you know, may or may not be her fault. Greg Kinnear's in there, and there's some really good
terrible guests. Greg Kinnear's terrible. I thought that's an awful character for him to play.
I don't know. I kind of felt that he didn't really have many scenes to do much at all. He was just kind of a bit backgroundy. Oh, but you've got some good guest stars in there. J.K. Simmons is there being very J.K. Simmons in the first episode.
The highlight for me, I think, is the young Nate Wolfe as the scenes with him in the prison early on when he bites the guy's leg, and then some of the stuff in Randall Flagg's Las Vegas hideaway. I think he brings a level of nuttiness and a level of madness to it that the rest of the miniseries could have used.
Yeah, see, I don't think the miniseries really gives him enough to really stand out. So he had those couple of great scenes when he was there by himself. But as soon as he becomes part of the larger story, I think he just kind of disappears into the background in the same way that I think Greg Kinnear disappears into the background. Hamish Linklater, who should be in a lot more things, he's in there fairly sort of charismatic in the first episode. The absolute best episode of the run, though, is one with Heather Graham in it, which I think is the second episode. And that's actually maybe the only episode where you spend a lot of time in pandemic times. And it's really Heather Graham and I can't think of the name of the gentleman playing the rock star in it, but it's the two of them walking around New York City. And it's a city which has got like a few sort of derelict people around. And it's kind of funny and it's sort of heartbreaking. And like, it's actually a traumatic experience watching it. It maybe goes on a little bit. It's a bit too long. Like, they don't give them enough to do while they're in this sort of space. But even so, like, it's a powerful episode of TV and the rest of it just doesn't really quite meet the standard of that.
Yeah, my dream girl, Heather Graham. I've always loved everything she's done, and I've always been sort of sorry that she didn't get a bigger break in Hollywood, despite having some, you know, really iconic roles to her name.
She's Roller Girl.
She was Roller Girl, yeah, in Boogie Nights. So, she is terrific in this. So, yeah, I give her credit.
Yeah. I think ultimately, I think the series is fine, but like, if they really wanted to make it pop, I kind of wish that. Look. They will argue that the flashbacks were always intended to be that way. But you can tell from the story, like, it's a lot more confident telling as soon as they enter a more linear fashion than this sort of cobbled together first couple of episodes. It doesn't feel right. And I just wish the show had actually owned up to the fact it was telling a story at the wrong time rather than to make these compromises. But by and large, like, it's watchable. I don't think people will have a terrible time with it, but it is somewhat of a frustrating time with it.
Yeah. Totally agree. I agree with you, Dan. That's not always going to happen, but I agree this time.
So, Simon, at the end of every podcast, we want to look at the week ahead. First of all, maybe let's start with some of the new and returning TV. There's a brand new show this weekend called Firefly Lane on Netflix. People might want to check out The End, which is a show coming on Foxtel on February 2nd. I reckon of anything like debuting over the next couple of days, like that's probably the one to check out. I haven't seen it yet, but it's got some very good
vibes. Sorry, mate. Yeah, look, it's got The End has just a who's who of Australian TV royalty. When you look at, when you consider names like Nonnie Hazelhurst and John Waters and Alex Dimitriades, Roy Billing, Robin Nevin, Brooke Satchwell, Foxtel are not leaving anything to chance in their support of local Australian product. They're getting all the names in there that have been mainstays of the Australian entertainment scene for the last 4,000 years. So it's good to see all these people back on television.
The person responsible for the show was Samantha Strauss, who her big credit previously was one of the co-creators of Dance Academy, which was a show for tween girls. But I'll actually say the quality of that show is actually way better than you expect it is if you haven't seen the show. Like, Dance Academy really is one of those special Australian productions. So it deserves all the success that it had over the last few years. And it's very exciting to see her doing something a little bit more adult orientated. So I'm very keen to check that out. Also on Foxtel, you've got an HBO drama called Industry, which is it's set in England a couple of years ago. It's about young British people who are entering the finance industry for the first time, and they get involved in drugs and sex. And, you know, it's a fun sort of soapy exploration. It's kind of like Boiler Room meets Beverly Hills 90210. It's a very fun show. I don't know why Foxtel has taken a few months to launch it here, but it is launching now finally. You can watch all of it on Binge or on Foxtel.
The movies going straight to streaming in the week ahead is a film on Apple TV Plus called Palmer. This is the Justin Timberlake film, if I understand.
Correct.
Yeah, very tough drama. Timberlake, there's been some early buzz that he's sort of in line for one of the Oscar acting nominations for his role in this one. He plays a kind of a wayward soul, a tough guy who connects with a disadvantaged young boy. The wonderful Juno Temple also stars in that, who I've been a big fan of for many years now. That's coming up on Apple TV Plus. The Dig is on Netflix. This is the very highbrow movie starring Ralph Fiennes and Carey Mulligan. She's everywhere at the moment with Promising Young Woman and now The Dig.
Yeah. Have you seen Promising Young Woman?
I have, yes, I've seen it. I love it. She's terrific. A lot of controversy through the week based on Variety's review of the film, which suggested she wasn't pretty enough or quote-unquote hot enough to play the vixen in the film. I totally disagree. She's beautiful and she's terrifying in this movie. It's a great performance.
Yeah, look, I think that's definitely one of the like true standouts of the last 12 months that I've seen. Like, it's incredibly good. I've got some issues with, I guess, the messaging that you're supposed to take away from the final act of the film without giving away too much. You know, I think by and large, like, it's definitely a film that people need to check out.
Yeah, I totally agree. Also coming to Netflix is a film called Finding Ohana, which is a Goonies-style adventure. In fact, just before we did this recording, Variety's review of Finding Ohana dropped, and they call it a really solid teenage Goonies-style adventure story, directed by a lady called Jude Weng, who's done so much episodic TV over the last 5 or 6 years. If you name a TV series, she's been behind the camera for it. So it's good to see her getting a feature film shot with Finding Ohana.
You've got a couple of films debuting in cinemas this weekend. So News of the World, which is the new Tom Hanks film, it is coming to Netflix in a couple of weeks' time, but it's getting a very brief cinema release in some select cinemas around the place.
Directed by Paul Greengrass, who's a fantastic filmmaker, did United, what was the film? United 53, the one about the plane? 93. And Tom Hanks, of course, who they're already touting as it's a Tom Hanks performance, so that means Oscar nomination. So probably worth seeing on the big screen. It's a Western, so you know the landscapes are going to look stunning.
Yeah, Tom Hanks, promising young ingenue. You may have seen him in Splash.
Yes, but his hair flowed down over his buttock, so you weren't offended by it.
Very disappointing. Now, there's a film that I'm very keen to see called Pixie, which when I saw the trailer for this, it reminded me a lot of the strong efforts through the mid to late 90s by UK cinemas to try to, and it kind of felt like a Harvey Weinstein, like Miramax sort of driven thing, to try to make some very commercial British movies. And this feels incredibly commercial in that same way, where I almost expect to hear some Britpop coming over.
A young woman played by Olivia Cook goes on the lam, as they call it, with a couple of tough young dudes, with a bunch of very sort of mean gangsters in chase. Yeah, I think you're right. This certainly sounds like something that could have starred Emily Lloyd back in the day. Look it up, kids. And yeah, has that sort of almost train spotting like energy. So yeah, I'm keen to see Pixie as well.
Yeah, it feels very much Shooting Fish 2.0.
Oh, Shooting Fish. Look at that for a reference. Wow.
Nothing but deep dives here. And there's an Australian film called High Ground.
High Ground stars Simon Denny. Is he Simon Baker or Simon Baker Denny? He's dropped a name somewhere along the way.
Simon Denny now.
Simon Denny. He's a hard man with a bad past, living in the Australian outback amongst the Indigenous people. That past catches up with him. And before you know it, you've got a beautiful looking, but I'm going to go out in a bit of a limb here. I don't usually come down too tough on Australian films, but it's kind of a hoary old Western B sort of movie feel about this. And although it looks beautiful and kind of feels important along the way, maybe I missed some of the point of this film, and people hearing this who've seen the film might say that I did. But to me, it was a very thin story bolstered by some pretty ripe acting against a beautiful backdrop. So, look, please go out and see it. Like I say, I'm all for Australian films and try to see as many as I can. This one I just don't think is living up to some pre-release hype, but definitely worth checking out.
I will say I'm getting pretty tired of seeing Australian films that always need to feel important. So that's maybe why Occupation Rainfall definitely ticked a lot of boxes for me.
Yeah, look, we're coming off. It's been a great summer for Australian films, as we mentioned in the interview, but The Dry was very good. I really like Penguin Bloom. The Furnace is a terrific movie. And Occupation Rainfall is just what we need right now. I just think High Ground could be the one that it stumbles a little bit out of the gate and is earning a lot of press coverage and a lot of acclaim that it maybe hasn't earned.
Now, something that I think earned every bit of conversation that surrounded it ever since its release is a film called Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I know of it.
You've heard of it before?
Yes, I have seen it before. Back into cinemas.
Small little indie film.
Yeah, let's get behind it. Let's really give it a push. The Indiana Jones series, and I will not call it Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. It was called Raiders of the Lost Ark in release.
All three films are being re-released. So this weekend, so starting last night really, Raiders of the Lost Ark is playing in cinemas in Sydney. You can see it at the Randwick Ritz Cinema as well as at the Hayden Orpheum. You'll find it in Brisbane playing at the Five Stars Cinema in New Farm. And I believe the Classic Cinema in Melbourne are playing it. There's probably other theatres around, but, you know, definitely check your local listings. But I can guarantee you'll find it there. This weekend, you've got Raiders of the Lost Ark. Next weekend, you've got the Temple of Doom. And then the week afterwards, a little film called Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Week four, though, if you're scratching around trying to find your Kingdoms of the Crystal Skull, maybe head home to your DVD collection.
Not going to happen. Boy, if there's one film in the Spielberg lineup that's the exception that proves the rule, it's Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. He's been quite open about the fact that it's not the film he intended to make. So you won't see that on the big screen. Take your DVD out from under your pot plant and watch it again at home, because it's just not good. But what that highlights is the absolute boom in retro releases, which we touched on earlier. The cinemas, certainly the independent cinemas, are so full of reworked and rehashed and redistributed product. Just this last week in Sydney, you could have gone to see Talking Heads' Stop Making Sense documentary, Almost Famous, the great Cameron Crowe film. These movies that would not have otherwise found cinema screens because of the lack of new product, they're finding not only screens but whole new audiences. So do check your local guides to relive some of those great movie memories.
Yeah, I actually think that the Ritz is playing Almost Famous the next couple of nights, and it's like a 35mm print.
Yeah,
and it's not the director's cut, which is the superior version of it, but it's still a pretty good watch.
Still worth seeing. Great, great film.
And just speaking of retro films, and we'll probably talk about this on next week's pod as well, there's a whole bunch of Wes Anderson films that are getting played through Dendy, so that might be something you want to put in your calendar for next weekend.
Not to mention the stunning lineup of Wong Kar-wai films. In the Mood for Love and several of his classics are also doing the rounds through the art gallery here in New South Wales, through the Dendy chain, I think through some of the Palace cinemas. So, a couple of his films have recently been restored. In the Mood for Love has had a 4K release. So we're deep diving into Asian cinema. There's plenty of time for that later.
Indeed. Anyway, we'll get to that later on the next episode of this little podcast called Screen Watching. Simon, it's been a pleasure. We'll be back next week. How do people get in contact with you generally?
Dan Barrett, you can get in contact with me via my website, screen-space.net, or ScreenSpace as it's known, all the Facebook channels. You can go and check out what I do over with the Sydney Science Fiction Film Festival. That's at Sydney Science Fiction Film Festival on Facebook. Drop us a line either way there. I'll answer all your movie questions.
People can find me. I do a daily newsletter called Always Be Watching, and you can find that at alwaysbewatching.com. You can do that. You can find me on Twitter at the Dan Barrett. If you've enjoyed this podcast, though, get the word out, because, you know, we'd like people listening to it. Like, it's important in these early phases to make sure we've got these things called listeners. And this is where you come in. Like, we need you people. So let your friends and your friends' friends know that this exists. So post about it on social media, send emails out to people telling them about the handsome men that are running this great new podcast. And Screen Watching you'll find on all the platforms that you'd usually find it. So Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, whatever podcast app you use, you'll probably find us there. This has been Screen Watching. We'll be back next week.